our occasional meander through the alphabet of modern Unix, today we're going to pay a stop off at the letter N for Nala. And if you are a Debian or Ubuntu user, you want to pay close attention.
Attention paid.
Why?
Why? This is terrific. You know how I like those terminal command things that take an old thing and spruce it up with colours and style and panache?
If you say so, yes.
Say goodbye to apt-get and say hello to Nala. Nala is an alternative front end to libapt. It does exactly what apt-get does, but it does it with style and panache.
I put it to you that people who use apt on the command line aren't looking for style and panache. They're looking for packages, but okay.
Well, why not both?
Yeah, okay.
You know, I get a lot of joy from my interaction at the command line when things look pretty and they behave in a nice way. And I can remember, Alan, I think you messaged the developer of apt a couple of years ago on Mastodon and said, yes, that new interface looks nice. Now add color.
I think I did, yes.
Well, there we go. This is me returning the torpedo you fed me a few weeks back. So yes. Nala is apt-get with color, but turned up to 11. It's not just color. It's a better command line syntax and UX. So a lot of the common commands are there, you know, install and remove and purge. But it has same defaults. So when you do a remove, it has the auto remove like turned on by default. So it does a full hoover up after itself. And when you install something by default, it actually does an update first. So you've always got the latest index to the packages ahead of you. And it presents all of this, as I say, with a lot of color and some style. And it's very elegant. So I really quite like this.
Does it have other things like dealing with the boot partition filling up when you add loads of kernels, or automatically purging old kernels? Or is that not a problem anymore? I don't remember, because I don't have a system with a small boot partition.
So I've looked into this a little bit. As I understand it, those cleanup operations are sort of buried in the apt backend. And this talks to that backend. So when it does its actions, the backend responds accordingly. So one example of that is a couple of years ago, Ubuntu added this feature where you can get phased updates. So sometimes when you do an update and an upgrade, it will tell you there are packages that are being held back. Well, Nala honors that because it's talking to the same backend. You know, it's not doing anything different. It's all talking through the same APIs and libraries and all the rest of it. But the reason I found this is that I'm working on a bit of a side project.
You, a side project?
I know.
You,
I know.
One side project?
Yeah, not one. I mean, you wouldn't believe the way my mind works. Oh, but anyway,
I very much would believe. Having had coffee with you most mornings for the last year or so, I agree.
Yeah. So I'm working on a side project, and there's some Ubuntu featuring in this side project. But also, I wanted some panache to what I was building. So I discovered Nala to fit in with the rest of the corpus of modern Unix tools that I like to have at my disposal.
So with this being an audio medium, it might be a bit difficult for our listeners to picture what apt with color might actually give them. So can you give us an idea of how it uses color and what it conveys? Or is it literally just it adds colored lines and glyphs everywhere and sparkles up your terminal?
It does sparkle up the terminal, and I'll explain in ways that maybe people that are familiar with apt will recognize. So one of my favorite ones is if you've ever done an apt show on a package and it prints out the big list of all of the dependencies and what have you, mm-hmm. apt doesn't wrap those lines. So you get like the first five packages and the rest of them are just lost to the void off the edge of the screen, never to be seen again, unless you pipe it through cat or bat or something like that. Nala not only separates each of the dependencies onto a separate line so they're readable, but it colorizes the whole display so you can see the different sections of the output, and you can immediately see where the depends are, where the recommends are, where the suggests are, the description of the package, and that sort of thing. So that's sort of a very let's say, simple way that it works. So it's not just color. There is some color there to draw your eye to what you want to see, but it's also the formatting. But when you actually come to like install and remove packages, you see the usual sort of going and getting the things, but it's all nicely indented and colorized and a little bit of progress as each one is indexed. But then when the actual install or removal starts, you sort of get this oblong at the bottom of the screen with curly line graphs and a nice bar graph that's colored and phased as it is going through the progress of what it's installing. So you don't just see a flurry of terminal activity. You actually see a very elegant progress bar with each package name being displayed on this overlay of the progress as it ticks through. But like apt, as opposed to apt-get, it sort of unifies all of the common apt commands. So you can apt install and remove and purge and all the rest of it, but you can also search and show. So unlike apt-get and that whole ecosystem of tooling, you don't have to step outside of one program to do all of the things you want to do. It does all of the common actions with a single keyword, and the defaults are the same for each one. And so it doesn't take long to learn and get up to speed with, and sort of things like the dash dash no recommends, which you may have used, all of that syntax that's common to apt-get is recognized by Nala.
Does Nala Moo work?
I don't know, actually. I haven't tried. I'm going to say no. I have read the documentation. I don't remember seeing it. But there you go. It's a fantastic project. It's been around for a while, so I'm sure there are people listening to this and thinking, oh, well done. You've just discovered something I've been using for years. But for those of you that haven't, every time you were using apt, you can now have some style and a pretty interface and also a sane front end to all things apt. I love Nala. I think it's terrific.
Previously on Linux Matters, I got a new car.
I remember. Is it still working?
It is still working.
Good.
Now, when I charge at home, I have an EV charger installed in my garage, which supports dynamic charging. And what that means is that my energy company decides exactly when my car charges and how fast it charges. And in return, I get a very cheap rate for all of that charging. They'll work out when there's more renewable energy available in the grid, and then they'll set everyone charging to use up the capacity. And there might be some national grid balancing scheme going on, which they'll get a kickback from. So then they will charge people's cars to use up that energy, for example.
So not knowing anything about EV stuff, this sounds like Economy 7, but for EV charging. Is that kind of an oversimplification?
It is kind of, in that it means I get a period overnight when I'm on basically an off-peak rate. But the way the dynamic charging works is if you have your car plugged in outside of that rate and they decide there's enough electricity, they will still give you that off-peak rate for the energy that they use to charge your car. And this worked really well with my old car, but not with my new car.
Oh.
Yeah. So my car and my charger would have a bit of an argument about whether it should be charging or not. And it would start charging, and then it would stop charging, and then it would start charging again, and it would say no. Or it would say, well, there's something wrong with the charger. And then the charger would say, well, your car didn't let me charge, and you should check the car, and you should check the charger, and no, he did it, and no, he started it, and so on.
What car have you got?
As you'll remember, Martin, I've got a Volkswagen ID3, whereas my previous car was a Citroen.
Okay, yeah, I absolutely remember that information.
Yes. So I fiddled around with this a bit, and I got in touch with the manufacturer of the charger, and they sent me a whole bunch of stuff to check, things like sending them pictures of the settings inside the car, because there's all sorts of things you can do to set, like charging limits and charging rates and schedules inside the car that might interfere with what the charger itself is trying to do. And then they looked at the charger on their side to see what had happened in the logs. And they could see that some chargers had failed. And then they got me to try some things like, did it work on a different AC charger? Which it did, because I used it on holiday and there was an AC charger at the holiday park, which was absolutely fine. And if I used the max charge setting, which is where it works like any other charger, you plug it in, you press max charge, and it just charges. And if it's not in the off-peak period, it charges you the full rate. And they asked me to do that for half an hour, send me the time and date, and then they could check at their end that that all looked good. And while I was doing this and sending it all off to them, I tried some other things as well. Because of how the dynamic charging works, essentially you tell it when you want the car to be ready by and how much you want it to be charged by, and it kind of works out what it needs to do within that period to charge it to your requirement. So I worked out that if I plugged it in so that it wouldn't be able to charge all the way, it would then have to set a schedule where it charges constantly as much as it can. And I found that if I did that, it worked. But if I plugged it in earlier in the day so that it could charge a bit and stop a bit and charge a bit and stop a bit, it didn't work. It would start charging and then I'd, you know, go to bed. I'd wake up in the morning. It would say, yeah, I charged at 7 p.m. by 2%, and then it did nothing else all night. So I sent all of this back to the manufacturer as well, along with the other information that they gave me.
So I find this fascinating because the both of you have got EVs.
And we both have the same charger at home as well.
Oh, we do, yeah.
Okay, well, that I didn't know. But Alan has described to me a debugging process he went through on a completely unrelated EV-related topic, where he'd clearly done a whole bunch of advanced thinking. My question to both of you is, how do you find being on the other end of this conversation, where we are normally the people who are supporting the people on the other end of the phone and asking them to go and gather information? Like, when you're the gatherer, like, how does it feel?
I can speak from my point of view because I had to go through a similar thing, but it was not quite the same, in that my first Mini would charge fine, but the OMI charger has the capability to talk directly to BMW using their API.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bit that failed for me.
Ah, that failed for me too.
I had a whole bunch of back and forth. I had video calls with the developers and they could never get it fixed. And that was in the first year of me owning the EV. And I just gave up and I removed the login credentials. So it just doesn't do that. But mine still works exactly as you've described properly. I just gave up. So there's your answer, Martin. I gave up.
Yes. So I also tried that API thing with the VW API. And in fact, now in the documentation, it says, if you have trouble charging, just disconnect the API.
Right.
Does it say those words in user-facing documentation?
Basically, yes. Yeah, it says, this is experimental. If it doesn't work, just try removing your credentials. So, yeah. So, Alan, your experience has enhanced the documentation for future users. But from my side, I actually found that all of the things they asked me, I could see why they were asking me. And when I sent them additional information they didn't ask for, they didn't just rigorously stick to the script. They, you know, took it on board and gave me sensible replies. And in fact, what we came to a resolution. So what they worked out was happening was, essentially, when it was doing this pattern of lots of small charge periods spread throughout the day, basically the car was going to sleep and not waking up again. There was too long in between the charge periods that it then became unresponsive. When the charger says, now charge again, it said, huh? So what they did was they pushed an update to the software on the EV charger, which sends wake-up signals more often in between charges. So now, basically, when it's got charging to do, it keeps the car awake, and then next time it charges, it's ready for the charge, and it's been working ever since.
I'm following. Your car has got wake on LAN.
Yeah, basically.
So when you were describing this problem, my car does the same thing, in that the charger will say, charge, don't charge, charge, don't charge. And every time it says don't charge, I get a notification from the car saying, oh, your charger may be broken, you should check it. And I completely ignore that because there's nothing wrong with the charger and it is charging the car. It's a completely erroneous message from my point of view, because it does actually charge the car. And I thought, huh, I wonder if there's some magic. And I think the magic I need to do is just turn off all notifications from the Mini app, and then I will live in ignorance.
I did also take the step of turning off all the notifications, yes. They are very noisy.
So that's two manufacturers of EVs, listeners. If you've got charging issues, you know what to do now. You turn off the API and you disable notifications and you live a happy life.
And make sure your car does not go to sleep by sending a constant wake on LAN. So, yeah, what could possibly go wrong? Plex is no longer best friend. I now love Jellyfin on my home server.
Welcome to the club.
So what prompted this technology shift?
Well, I tried Jellyfin in the past and I couldn't get on with it for a few reasons. I think I didn't give it enough chance. Or maybe it was broken at the time. Or maybe the apps didn't work. I don't know.
Didn't you try loving it hard enough?
Yeah, that must be it. So yes, what I did was love it a little bit harder by really looking a bit harder for the apps that go on all the devices that I need it to run on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems I had with Plex was logins and authentication and stuff, especially for multiple members of the family. And I've killed two birds with one stone by having just one username and password that the whole family use.
Because you just don't care anymore because all of your family are adults now.
Well, there is that. Yes, I guess. I mean, I could put extra special videos on there that I don't want any of them to watch, but I'm not going to do that. You know, like Linux tutorials that I've downloaded from the internet.
Yeah, how to download your Ubuntu ISO.
Yeah, exactly. I think I probably made some of those. No, they don't want to see those. They don't want to see their dad like that.
No, they really don't.
So what I did was I installed Jellyfin. I pointed it at a folder with some video files. And then it turns out that most of the devices I have actually do have a Jellyfin app right there. The first one is on the main TV in the lounge, which is a dumb old smart TV with like no app support. I could not get the DNLA or DLNA, whatever.
Oh yeah, DLNA, yeah.
That I couldn't get that working on my Sony TV. But I have a Amazon stick plugged into it. And it turns out there is a Jellyfin app directly there. I didn't need to sideload. I didn't need to do any nonsense. I just moved the little cursor across, clicked on Jellyfin, and it found the server, put in the username and password, done. I can watch stuff. So main TV in the lounge, done. The other one was a TV in my son's room, which is a cheapo, smart LG TV. And the last time I looked at it, I couldn't find any. The user interface is WebOS, and it is absolutely atrocious and dog slow.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find how to install additional apps, or even if there was a capability to do that. Well, I just had a bit more patience this time, and it turns out there is, and there is a Jellyfin app in there, logged in, and it's perfectly able to now stream my Linux tutorials from the box in the loft directly to my son's room, which he is delighted by.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's an app on all the mobile devices as well, and I can view it in a browser on my laptop, so I'm good. I don't need Plex anymore. Jellyfin is king.
I've got Jellyfin and Plex running, but I'm the only person that looks at Jellyfin. The issue that I've had with it is that on our TVOS, so Apple TV devices, the app there has been a bit unreliable. So it hasn't quite passed my sort of reliability test for putting in front of the family. So how's your experience been across all of the like mobile devices?
So far, not a problem. I use it on my iPhone 13 mini. I've used it on various laptops of varying ages and it seems to cope just fine. Actually, the thing that I was more surprised by was that the poor little HP microserver it's running on in the loft is able to deliver the bits and re-encode on demand and scan libraries and find media and transcode and do all of that nonsense without breaking too much of a sweat.
My Jellyfin server is still running on my OG HP microserver of yore. So how do your family react when you suddenly one day run around the house and go and reconfigure all the devices and say, stop using Plex, I've got something new, you will need to use Jellyfin now? Does that go down okay? Are they just used to it by now?
Well, I've bypassed that by not actually giving them Plex in the first place because of the whole user thing. It was there and they all had access, but they're all terrible at remembering passwords and Plex kept kicking them out every so often. And so they never ended up getting comfortable enough to use it. Now, maybe they should have contacted technical support and they would have been helped. But whenever I asked them about Plex, they'd just say, oh no, don't use it. It's like rubbish. And on one occasion, I actually had to, in order to get my son happy in watching something, I SSH'd to the server that had Plex on it. And I used Python to run up an HTTP server. and gave him the URL. So on his desktop PC, he could just click it, or on his phone, he could just click it and watch the video directly. Mm. I was like, I don't need any of this media stuff. Like, just Python HTTP server is fine.
I know podcasts in our genre jump to enshittification quite quickly, but I do feel like Plex is a poster child for enshittification, because it did used to be absolutely wonderful. And in pursuit of sort of monetization through additional means, because I think those lifetime licenses kind of bit them a little bit, you know, back in the day, it's just had all of its joy sucked out of it and all of its usefulness. And that whole authentication thing, I'm never quite sure what I'm logging into with Plex anymore. I don't know if I'm actually signing into my Plex server or some other random hosted service of theirs.
So the other thing that I use Jellyfin for, I thought, well, while I've got video files on there, I could also put other things. So I created a media library of books of various types. I've put the books that I have in PDF form, comic books that I've obtained from places like, oh crikey, what's it called? What's that?
Humble Bundle.
Humble Bundle. Yes, I've got a whole bunch of those. And also audiobooks that I have liberated from places. I've put those in there as well. Now, that was a bit strange, because I have to keep reminding myself of the weird directory structure that Jellyfin expects. You know, is it books and then books and then the author's name, and then within that the title, and then within that is where the files go? You can't just have a folder with the author's name and put all their books in one. I'm sure you probably can, but for some reason Jellyfin has this prescribed structure, and it's slightly different whether it's a traditional paper ebook or whether it's an audio version of a book. It's a bit weird. I don't find that particularly fun, but now that I have those directories created, when I get another book, I just look in the directory and go, oh yeah, that's how that needs to be arranged. But it never sticks in my head, because it's different for books and comics and audiobooks, which makes no sense. That's the only niggle I have. And I'm able to browse my audiobooks directly in the Jellyfin app and put an audiobook on before I go to bed. And it's really nice.
Mm, excellent.
I'm really pleased with it. So I'm going to stick with Jellyfin, and I don't think I'll be logging into my lifetime license of Plex anytime soon.
Yeah.
I've already disabled the snap. I'll probably remove it pretty soon. And everyone's happy.